on the telephone right now. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I love talking baseball, and it's always fun talking Seattle Mariners.
So the average length of a career for a Major League Baseball player is 5.6 years, which means most Major League players don't make it out of their late 20s in the league. You pitched until you were 49. How did you do it?
Wow. I could probably take up all your time with that answer alone. You know, there's really not one antidote. There's not one simple message. You know, good health. I was doing a thing as I played called prehab. I would do rehabilitation work, even though I wasn't hurt, in my off season, to help me put myself in a better situation to have my health.
And, you know, that off season regimen and just the regimen of a professional athlete in general, that can't be easy. And you have eight children, is that right?
Yes,
who you no doubt love to spend time with. What is it about the game of baseball that was worth all of that time and effort?
When you're with a team, you're trying to create a common goal or reach a common goal with your teammates. And I think there's something special about that. And I think that's where the love came. And I think as I grew, the passion came. You know, throughout the course of my career, I realized that, you know, that team perspective is very important. And I realize that now here at home with eight children. You know, we kind of have a team here at home. And so, you know, my baseball life really kind of flooded itself into my everyday life, and my everyday life kind of flooded itself into my baseball life. And, you know, it just really worked. And, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't want it any differently.
So when you watch professional baseball now as, I guess, as a spectator, do you ever say to yourself, I could still do that?
You know, my heart says that, and my mind wants to say that, but my body is saying, no, you can no longer do that. So, yeah, at the age of 52, like you say, it's something that I wish that I still could do. You know what? I think I could maybe go out and do it one day, but it would take me far longer to recover than it did when I was an active player.
So this week on the show, we're going to explore the theme for love of the game. And Jamie Moyer, thank you so much for helping us get the show kicked off today. And congratulations on being inducted into the Mariners Hall of Fame this year.
Well, thank you very much. That's a huge honor.
We'll get more into For Love of the Game in a few minutes, but first we'll sit down with some friends and catch up on the week's news. Don't go away. Well, if you missed the big stories, or perhaps some stories that maybe should have been bigger, fear not. We've got some smart people joining us now, pumped full of coffee and carbs to help us take a closer look at some of these stories. I'm Kevin Kniestead. This is Sound Effect, and joining us this morning is Nina Shapiro, senior editor at Seattle Weekly, Benjamin Romano, editor at Xconomy Seattle, and Jessica Partnow, co-founder and executive director at the Seattle Globalist. Good morning, and welcome to Sound Effect.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
Well, our top story this week is the 10-count federal indictment of Washington State Auditor Troy Kelly. Kelly pleaded not guilty Thursday to charges of filing false tax returns, lying to federal agents, and stealing from title company customers. The case stems from his prior work in the real estate industry. I want to start with you, Jessica Partnow. I'd like to ask you, what exactly did we learn on Thursday?
Well, the part of the accusation that's really stuck with me is these fees that it's alleged his company was keeping from borrowers, and they were supposed to be returned. And I felt like his response didn't really directly respond to anything that I saw in the indictment.
It was, I did nothing wrong. I never thought I was doing anything wrong. Did you see his quote? I thought
yeah.
that was really
yeah.
funny.
Yeah, that was an important distinction.
Yeah, exactly.
Nina Shapiro, what else did we learn?
We learned some interesting details, like allegedly he directed his staff to create fake spreadsheets. And it was interesting because, you know, this was a real estate company, and I think it's good to keep in mind that this was boom years, right? There was a lot of crazy illegal stuff happening, frankly. So fake documents, made up income requirements. I mean, just think of everything we've learned about what's happened with the real estate industry during that time. So I think there was another quote that he had about this was standard industry practice at the time. Well, yeah, a lot there of things
lot
were
of standard industry practice exactly. going on then that is no longer happening
exactly.
these days.
Exactly.
I was interested in the fact that these allegations had been swirling around Kelly even while he was running for office, and his attorneys were asked about why he would run, knowing that this was out there. And certainly, you know, he has to have his day in court before we make any final judgments. But I wonder, you know, what additional weight this might give to allegations that surround, you know, people seeking elected office in the future. But in general, this is just another case of undermining our faith in government. I mean, the auditor's office is here to hold state and local government
Absolutely.
Accountable for the use of public resources. So, yeah. you know, this is one of those really galling situations if it
And vigorously
true.
Did so under his predecessor. That was the thing, is that Brian Sontag was like the epitome of holding people accountable, being scrupulously professional. I mean, he did so many high-profile audits when you thought this is the place to turn to find out what's happening in public office.
Why didn't these allegations prior to the election seem to carry more weight?
Maybe because they were just allegations at that time, and I suppose they still are. I'm wondering going forward whether, you know, this coming to light now will cause voters to pay more attention in future elections.
Well, look, it's a very complicated case. I mean, it's hard to really understand what was going on. This all stemmed from a civil lawsuit. So there was somebody, another company that was trying to recover money
yeah. mm-hmm.
from him. So it's hard to know the ins and outs. I mean, it's hard to even understand what exactly his company does. How many people understand what an escrow company really does and what those fees were for and why he was supposed to collect 150 but then return 130? I mean, I think that's something that's really hard for the voters to understand.
He has been called by, he was immediately called by yeah. party members and the governor to resign, and instead it looks like he's going to take just a leave of absence. Does that suggest anything to you, Jessica Partnow?
Well, I think it's interesting. It sounds like there's not really precedent for elected officials taking a leave like that, so it's kind of just stalling the system.
This, again, goes to the purpose of the auditor's office and how well it can function given the controversy swirling around the auditor. So, you know, this is a situation where regardless of his guilt or innocence, the distraction created by the federal indictment seems to me to be a reason to get out of the way and let an important office of state government do its work.
All right. Well, that's our top story for the week. Why don't we move on to our overreported stories of the week? Let's start with you, Nina Shapiro.
Some of you may have heard that some elephants left town this week. I don't know how you may have heard that unless you saw like the constant coverage about it, including a King 5 helicopter that was hovering over the zoo to capture every moment of the moving process. So if you actually looked on that live stream that they were filming, you saw a couple of trucks and not much else, but there you had it for anybody who was interested. So I will say it is an important story. There's been some excellent journalism about the treatment of elephants in the zoo. There was a great investigative story a couple of years ago in the Seattle Times with some amazing details about how they inseminate elephants, for instance, that is fascinating. But I think at this point, we're really in overkill territory.
Jessica Partnow, you agreed with her for the overreported story of the week?
Yeah. I mean, I love elephants too, but I think it was just absolutely too much. I thought it was interesting that this week's social media was also kind of swept with the extinction of the black rhino. And there were a lot of posts sort of saying like, wow, humans caused extinction of this animal, which is true, but that actually happened in 2006. It was one of those rumors that just kind of picked up steam this week, randomly, mm-hmm. I guess.
Benjamin Romano, you have a different overreported story for the week?
Yeah, I was interested by the news that the CEO of a company in Seattle called Gravity Payments, which does credit card processing, announced that he's going to raise all his employees to a salary of $70,000 a year over the next 3 years, in part by cutting his own pay. And this got tons of national attention. It was a pretty good PR move for the company, which had the New York Times on hand to film the announcement live and, of course, see the cheering employees. My thought is that, you know, this kind of fits with the broader theme of looking at our $15 an hour minimum wage. Socialist City Council member Shama Sawant and comments from folks like Nick Hanauer, a wealthy Seattle venture capitalist, about the need for a multi-pronged effort to address income inequality. And, you know, they're rightly highlighting Seattle as an epicenter for this conversation, but I think the national coverage sometimes gives the impression that we've figured it out here, right, when, in fact, we've still got, you know, quite a long way to go, particularly when you look at housing affordability. This morning, I just jumped on Zillow to see, you know, what a $70,000 a year income could buy you in Seattle in terms of a house, and that gets you about a home of about $305,000, and the median Seattle home listing price is $455,000, right, and we've all heard the stories recently of bidding wars and those listing prices being nowhere near what homes are actually going for. So even at that, you know, handsome pay increase for the folks at Gravity Payments, it's still going to be tough to buy a home, let alone if you're making $15 an hour to rent one.
Right. So. Well, thank you for those overreported stories. Let's move on to underreported stories. By the way, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestad in for Gabriel Spitzer. And we're joined again this week by Nina Shapiro, Jessica Partnow, and Benjamin Romano. Ben, what's your underreported story?
So my underreported story this week is that we've got another energy company scoping locations in the Northwest for an oil refinery, which would be one of the first to be built on the West Coast in a generation. The environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper released documents they had found from the port of Longview, Washington, indicating that a company called Riverside Energy was negotiating for space to build this refinery last summer. We've seen oil prices drop substantially since then, which might do as much as any kind of environmental opposition to stymie an energy project like this. If this goes forward, it's just another piece of the broader kind of fossil fuels export story that and exploration story that's been present in the Northwest here, and including the kinds of deals like the Port of Seattle made with Shell to house their Arctic drilling ships here for the summer.
All right, Jessica Partnow, what's your underreported story this week?
Well, my underreported story is about the lack of a pipeline that we have for our international students to find work in the U.S. after they finish their education. I think we've all heard a lot about how there's been a massive increase in the number of international students coming to study in the U.S., and particularly at an institution like the UW, where I also teach journalism, the number of international students has more than doubled in recent years. And every spring, about this time of year, the panic starts to set in for a lot of my students. Mm. Because they basically have 90 days after they graduate to find a job or they have to go home. And these students are in the same situation as any college student. You know, you're still in school. You're kind of living in this dream world. The real world is far away. But then you're out in the real world. It's mm-hmm. over. You know, you're not kind of in this protective shell of your educational institution. And these students really don't know. It's a huge sort of life path decision for them whether they can try and find a job here or if they just are going home and their life is completely changing.
Is it that 90-day period that seems to be the biggest problem, or what other challenges are they facing outside of that?
I think one is that I really don't see a ton of recruitment. So it's interesting, we have a lot of tech companies here in Seattle who are obviously looking all over the world for new employees and bringing people from all over the world. I don't see a huge pipeline from students that are here already and already sort of making the cultural adaptations and learning that would really help them in a job here in the U.S.
So why is that? Why it seems like it would almost be easier to take a student who has made that, you know, who has spent time here, an international student who has spent time here, rather than getting someone from overseas that hasn't spent any time here at all. Why aren't they recruiting from in-house, for lack of a better way to put it?
In some ways, I think it's a bureaucratic challenge with the way that the immigration process works. It's really, really difficult to get visas and to transition from the student F1 visa to the H1 visa that you need to actually work and have a job here. There's not a clear, really obvious way to do it. It's very tricky sort of on a bureaucratic level.
Nina Shapiro, what's your underreported story of the week?
Yeah, well, I actually have another immigration story. So a couple weeks ago, there was a pretty significant federal ruling on a case that came out of Anacortes. And this was about an immigrant, an artist, who was stopped by a local police officer for a very minor traffic violation for making a left turn without indicating. But the local officer apparently took it upon himself to wonder and question about whether this was an undocumented immigrant and called the Border Patrol. He ended up being detained and taken to the Northwest Detention Center. This is a case from 2011. The judge ruled that this was an illegal stop, that you have to have probable cause due to the Fourth Amendment to detain somebody, and the officer didn't have it. And essentially what the officer was doing was racial profiling. And then it emerged that this happened all the time in 2011, 2012, of the Border Patrol roaming around and essentially looking for reasons to question Hispanics, whether they were documented or not. And there were a series of lawsuits about that challenged that, including this one that led to this ruling. And we all kind of dropped the story, and I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. I wrote a lot about it at the time, but I realized when this ruling came through, I had no idea if these kinds of practices were still going on by the Border Patrol. So I did a little digging around into that this past week, and I found out that it was a surprisingly good news story in that the lawsuits really did have an effect, and people have been telling me that those kinds of practices have largely died down, which is pretty amazing when you consider how vigorously the Border Patrol defended what they were doing at the time. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, some of those stops still continue, and I did find out about one stop that happened just this past November.
Well, a big thank you this week to our guests, Nina Shapiro, senior editor at Seattle Weekly, Benjamin Romano, editor at Xconomy Seattle, and Jessica Partnow, co-founder and executive director at the Seattle Globalist. Thank you all so much for being on Sound Effect today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, it's all for love of the game. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. Listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestad, in for Gabriel Spitzer. And of course, if we're talking love of the game here in Seattle, the talk must turn to video games. This region has become a mecca for game development, which includes not just the people making games, but also the folks acting in them. One Seattle husband and wife in particular have found fame as voice actors in the nerdy but vibrant gaming universe. KPLU's Ashley Gross introduces us to them.
Ellen McLean has had a long career as an opera singer. But now, this is what she's famous for.
Here's an interesting fact. You're not breathing real air. It's too expensive to pump this far down.
That is McLean doing the voice of GLaDOS. GLaDOS is the sweet-sounding but passive-aggressive computer in the games Portal and Portal 2. McLean's husband, John Patrick Lowry, began his career as a guitar composer. But he's now famous for doing the voice of the snarky Australian sniper in the game Team Fortress 2.
Professionals have standards. Be polite. Be efficient. Have a plan to kill everyone you meet.
These games are blockbusters. If you're 20 years old, you've probably played them. So this is a story of unlikely fame for a couple now in their early 60s. The video game industry was embryonic when McLean and Lowry moved to Seattle from New York in 1989.
You know, we just packed up a truck, we packed up that old piano, and we just moved out, and our first gig here, our first gig here, was packing fish eggs.
At a salmon egg factory.
For Cossack Caviar.
That's
I don't know if they still exist.
Right.
Their careers on stage started to take off. McLean got lots of opera roles in Seattle and Tacoma. Lowry decided to focus on acting instead of composing, and he put together a voice demo and did some instructional videos and things for Boeing. And then his agent sent him on video game auditions.
The first video game I did was a thing called the Spy Fox Breakfast Cereal.
What did your agent say, and what was your reaction?
Well, the agent doesn't say anything. The agent said, hey, I got an audition for you tomorrow at, 3:30. It was just a video game. It's like, oh, okay, cool. I mean, it didn't matter. It was like it was a gig.
In those days, the mid-90s, game developers were not too sophisticated. Lowry says they'd hand him some lines to read with absolutely no direction. One time, he remembers his line was simply, goodbye, son.
And I said, why am I saying goodbye to him? And what's going on? Call up the writer and say, okay, so what's happening? This is a place where the game branches, and your son is either going to, go down to the store and be right back, or he's going to step through this interdimensional gateway and go to another universe, and you're never going to see him again. So could you say it in a way that would work either way? So I said, goodbye, son. Great, that's great. That'll work fine.
Lowry says developers began to realize they needed to give more direction to the actors if they wanted sophisticated cinematic games. Lowry told his wife to audition, but McLean was reluctant at first.
I hear all the ads on the radio, and I hear all the voiceover work, and it's male-dominated, and it's still male-dominated.
Yeah.
And I thought, why should I do this? I'd never get work. Well, never say never.
Initiating surprise in 3, 2, 1.
They told the actors who were auditioning to sound as much like this computer-generated voice as you possibly could.
I feel awful about that surprise. Tell you what, let's give your parents a call right now.
In Portal, GLaDOS the computer has you do puzzles in the name of science. But you slowly start to discover she is not on your side. She keeps promising you cake if you'll do what she says. Finally, to win, you, the gamer, have to find GLaDOS and destroy her. And even then, while the credits are rolling, GLaDOS taunts you with a song called Still Alive.
Can you leave me? I am still alive. I'm doing science and I'm still alive.
24 hours after the game was released, 24 hours, we'd never gotten a fan email before. We got a fan email from Denmark saying, people are in the streets of Copenhagen chanting, the cake is a lie, the cake is a lie. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm married to a world famous person now.
But Lowry's famous too, not just for the sniper, but also for Pudge the Butcher in the game Dota 2. At gaming conventions, people wait for hours for their autographs. And podcasters from as far away as India do gushing interviews.
Guys, welcome to the show where we talk to Pudge.
Oi, hello. You know what I like? I like fresh meat.
Oh my God, I've got goosebumps. If you can see here, I've got goosebumps. This guy is phenomenal.
For McLean and Lowry, this is all a little bizarre. McLean doesn't even play video games. She likes bridge. But now they have this link to a younger generation. And sometimes, just for fun, they reveal their video game alter egos to random strangers.
I'll see, say, a 17-year-old boy walking down the street, and as I go by, I'll say, we're a lot alike, you and I. You tested me. I tested you. You killed me. Oh, wait a minute. I guess I haven't killed you yet. Well, food for thought. And I totally blow their mind.
So how does it feel to have this be what you're famous for? I mean,
it's miraculous to me.
Surreal.
McLean and Lowry say they never could have imagined this career for themselves, but they say it's fun and gratifying to play the characters so many people around the world love or love to hate.
This was a triumph. I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture science. We do what we must because we can. for the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense crying over every mistake. You just keep on trying till you run out of cake. And the science gets done and you make a neat con for the people who are still alive. I'm not even angry. I'm being so sincere.
That story from KPLU's Ashley Gross. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Kevin Kniestad, in for Gabriel Spitzer. And this week, we are exploring the theme for love of the game. But what happens when the game doesn't exactly love you back? Maybe another way to put that is that the game might not fairly compensate you for the time you put into it. That's what happened to Garrett Brushhouse. He's an attorney from St. Louis who helped file a lawsuit on behalf of dozens of minor league baseball players, some who were part of the Seattle Mariners organization, claiming that Major League Baseball violated the Fair Labor Standards Act and state laws by paying them less than minimum wage and failing to compensate them for overtime. And he joins us now. Mr. Brushhouse, welcome to Sound Effect.
Thanks, Kevin.
So give us an overview of the lawsuit and where it stands right now.
Sure. So we originally brought it back in February of 2014, so just over 12 months ago. And we started with three guys. And at its root, it's just a wage and hour action. So it seeks to apply the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the basic minimum wage and overtime law for this country. And it also applies several of the state laws. So it's been a little over a year. We've made some progress, but of course, large-scale litigation like this, it takes a while to play out. And since we have now expanded the lawsuit to include all 30 major league teams, along with the Office of Commissioner of Baseball, commonly known as Major League Baseball, and Commissioner Selig. Since we have that many defendants and we have dozens of plaintiffs also, there are going to be a lot of depositions in this case.
Okay, explain how minor league baseball players aren't getting paid for their work.
Well, it's quite shocking, really, when you see the numbers. You know, I think most people assume that minor league players aren't getting rich. And since they are minor league players and not major league players, it makes sense that they wouldn't be getting rich. But the salaries are extremely low. Every person that enters the minor league system signs the same contract. It's a 7-year form contract. The team can do whatever the heck they want with you over that time period. And you can't leave the organization unless you retire. And everybody starts at $1,100 per month, only paid during the season. So at the lowest levels of the minors, you're talking about $5,000 or less that guys are often making for the entire year. And that contract obligates them to do stuff throughout the year. So for instance, thousands of guys are going to spring training. They're going to be working 50 hours a week. They'll work 7 days a week. They won't have a single day off unless it rains a lot. And they won't be getting their salaries at all during that time period. The winter training period is another period where guys are required to do all kinds of off-season activities. And again, they aren't paid their salaries at all.
How can they be required to do activities such as winter ball and not get paid for it?
That's a good question. And then that's why we've brought our lawsuit. You know, in the normal world, you talk to almost any businessman, and he knows that if he's requiring someone to do training, then he's got to pay that person for it. And yet they aren't paying their salaries at all for that, and it just doesn't make sense. And, of course, we think it's illegal.
These minor league players did sign contracts. Is any of what they are going through not specifically laid out in the contracts that they sign?
No, you are absolutely correct. They all sign contracts, and they all sign these uniform contracts. But one thing that the wage and hour laws make clear is you can't sign away your right to a minimum wage. Otherwise, you would see all these companies like McDonald's or Walmart signing everybody to employment agreements for $5 an hour. So as a matter of policy, you can't sign away your right to a minimum wage.
Would you say that the average minor league player signing their first contract, I'm assuming ages 18 to 22, somewhere in that range, fully understands what they are signing?
Well, you talk to lots of guys, and they don't know what they're signing, you know, especially in the Latinos. They're 16 often when they're signing these contracts. So you're a 16-year-old Latino. A lot of those Dominicans are living in an impoverished neighborhood, and so they're desperate to get out of the Dominican Republic. Yeah, of course they're going to sign this contract. They could put in any term that they wanted to, and they would sign that contract. And for a lot of American guys, it's not much different either. You know, they're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, and they've dreamt of being a professional baseball player their entire life. And so when presented with this contract, yeah, they're going to sign it.
So prior to becoming a lawyer, you yourself were a minor league baseball player. What was your experience like?
Sure. So I played 6 years in the San Francisco Giants organization. So I initially got into minor league baseball, and I'll never forget one of my first friends I made was a guy from Venezuela. And we're sitting there doing running one day, and he starts talking about having a girlfriend who's pregnant back home, and he's just trying to save up $20 a month to send back to her, just anything he can, and he was having trouble doing that. And it just, you know, it just didn't make sense to me. And then in later years, you know, I spent a couple of years sleeping on futons and host families' basements. You know, I saw guys cramming 5, 6, 7 guys into a 2-bedroom apartment, sleeping on air mattresses during the season. And it didn't seem right to me. You know, the amount of money that is in this game and in the industry and the amount of money that Major League Baseball is taking in, they were a $9 billion industry last year. It just didn't seem right. And so during my last year of playing, when I basically knew that my career was over, I started studying for the LSAT on the buses. You know, everybody else is playing cards, playing poker, watching movies, and I'm quietly studying for the LSAT, hoping nobody sees that I have these crazy nerdy books open. And then a few days after the season ended, I took the LSAT and went to law school.
All right, so I was a lowly Division III college tennis player. I spent hours and hours on the courts and in training rooms and on buses. And I have to say that despite my hard work and the hard work I put in, I was aware of the reality that despite my hard work, I wasn't going to make it to the professional tour. I knew exactly where I stood alongside my tennis peers. So it's kind of hard for me to imagine that many of these baseball players are any less aware of their odds. So why do they put themselves through this low-wage torture when the odds are against them?
You know, hope springs eternal in baseball. It really does. You know, you as Division III tennis player, you know, you were probably watching Pete Sampras play and realizing you weren't the second coming of Pete Sampras. Mm-hmm. But you know, for a lot of these baseball players, if you talk to them still today, they would tell you that they think that they were just a break or two away from being a major leaguer.
And is that, you know, does that mentality come from just from themselves, or are there coaches within the organizations that are telling them this to keep them on the roster so these rosters stay full? Where does that come from?
You know, it's difficult to say exactly. If you are in minor league baseball, you're in the top 1% at what you do. You are a very, very talented baseball player. And you look around you at the guys that are rated the top prospects, and a lot of times you're performing as well as the guys that are rated top prospects. And so it's a very, very tough thing to turn away from. You keep thinking that, hey, I'll just have a big year. That next year is going to be the big year, and then I'll make it into the major leagues. It's an incredibly emotional and a fairly stressful thing to deal with.
After all of this, do you still love baseball?
I have a weird relationship with baseball. But yes, I do still love it. I probably love it, you know, a different way than what the normal fan loves it. But you know, if you're a journalist, for instance, or a copy editor, your love for journalism is probably going to be different than the average person that's reading the newspaper. Mm. And so it's probably somewhat like that. When I go to a game these days, I love going to a baseball game. I love watching all the little things that the pitcher's doing on the mound. I love seeing a guy execute a perfect changeup. I love a guy seeing a guy throw both a cutter and a sinker. It's just such a tough thing to do. And so I do still love the game. I just don't love the labor policies that they have.
Here at Brush House, an attorney from St. Louis and also a former minor league baseball player, he's helped file a lawsuit on behalf of several minor league baseball players, some who were part of the Seattle Mariners organization, claiming that Major League Baseball doesn't fairly compensate minor league players. Mr. Brush House, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been exploring the love of the game, but what about the game of love? It's hard enough for people to win at love themselves, but is it possible to win vicariously? Sophia Andreeva is the CEO and sole proprietor of Sophisticated Matchmaking on Mercer Island, and for a mere $10,000, she'll try to match you with the love of your life. But it's not just for rich people.
I have a millionaire divisions when I work with a lot of wealthy people, like, entrepreneurs and business owners and retired people. And I also have just professional group making under $100,000 a year. I mean, like regular people.
Still, $10,000 is a lot for most people, especially when a lot of self-help books, dating websites, and, of course, grandparents say they can also help you win at the game of love. Why is Sophia the Yenta different? Sam Horn went to Mercer Island to find out.
So people say love is a game, but if it really is, how do you win?
You're only in the game as far as you're playing. You're still playing it, you're out. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. You want an example?
Sure.
Like, for example, let's say some people believe that, some women believe that if you play unavailable to the men, you will create more desire of that man towards you. Right? So, because men want what they can't have. So let's play the game. The thing is, you can play this and you can get this man. The problem starts when you start becoming available to him. Because by playing this game, you are getting the results of attracting that man on your side. But keeping that man for long, you can't, because as soon as you become yourself, he's not interested anymore. Because you attracted ego-driven man who wants to get what he can't have. Once he gets you, interest to you diffusing. And he wants a new target. So what was the purpose of the game again? To get the score or to get everlasting love?
So what about things like the pickup artist? It's a system that says men can find dates and love by doing things like giving insults to women that makes the women think that these men have higher value.
If the goal is to get laid, that works. There's nobody arguing about this. The problem happens if you like her and want her to stay. Because I would say a lot of men who have to do the pickup artist strategies are not very good in connecting with women. If you're doing this for fun, or you just have a crazy summer, and that's one thing. If you're looking for a life partner long term, it's another game, right? If you're just making the number to feel yourself sexy and like an alpha male based on how many women you got, and it brings you satisfaction, that's fine too. But there is a lot of men who would say getting women means nothing.
How do you decide whether you'll take on a client? I know that the process involves a 3-hour interview. Sophia, what do you find out in those 3 hours?
1 hour is just to break ice. It's not enough. Second hour, you start opening up. And the third hour, I ask all the questions so I get everything out of you, because you can't fake it for 3 hours. It's hard. So these 3 magical hours help me to sink in with you. Open mindedness in my process and cooperation with me of a client is crucial. Because success rate depends on how the client is cooperative with the matchmaker.
Sophia, does everyone follow the rules?
Very often, people go and meet somebody against my recommendation, right? So I would say maybe you should not go for girls 25 years younger with no job anymore, because you know what happened to you last time you did this. And they say, oh, I understand, but I like them the most. And they go and meet them again, and then they get married. Is it a win or not? I don't know about that. So I surely helped to meet them. But I guess I look at this in the way that I provide the client what they're looking for. It's not up to me to change your life course. It's up to you.
All right, Sophia. Have you ever met people who you really can't help?
Let's imagine it's an older man who's out of shape, who's not very tall. Let's say he's bald. He's not very wealthy either, but he wants to meet a beautiful, gorgeous woman who looks like Playboy Bunny from the magazine, and she's educated, and she is in her 30 for 35 years old. Is it realistic or not?
No.
It could be if that man, for example, had so much to offer to the woman besides money and looks, that the woman will be blown away by how intimate he is, how emotionally available he is, how much he turned her life to be his focus, how, you know, like, it's like going above and beyond what an average man will do. It could happen, actually. I've seen that. But most people don't.
Sophia Andreeva of Mercer Island's Sophisticated Matchmaking hasn't been able to win at love herself. She's been divorced a few times and even had a wedding called off this year. Maybe the biggest lesson to learn is optimism. If you've ever listened to KPLU on a Sunday afternoon, say, any time in the last three-plus decades, there's a good chance you've probably heard Ken Wiley. His program, The Art of Jazz, offers one of the most complete musical history lessons on jazz that you can find on the radio. Prior to his broadcasting career, Ken was an educator in the Tacoma school system, and during that time compiled a record collection that would make the Smithsonian jealous. And when he retired from teaching, he found his way to share his love and passion for the music over the airwaves.
A friend of mine said something. We were out drinking somewhere, and he said, you know a lot about the music. Why don't you get a job on the radio? And I went, you know, where? And he said, well, you know, Pacific Lutheran University has a radio station. I said, really? So I went away with that thought in mind, and a couple of weeks later, I got the phone book and looked at him, called, and talked to Scott Williams, who was the program director at that time. I'm talking about 1982. And he said, hey, you called at the right time. The one guy that we have doing the program, that's all they had then, has to leave. And so why don't you come out, we'll talk and whatever. And that led to it. About a week later, I was on the air. It was the 10th of July, 1982, and I was on from 10 p.m. till midnight. So that's what happened, and I stepped into that and enjoyed it, and they seemed to enjoy it, and pretty soon, I don't know, for several months, I guess I was doing it that way. Then they gave me Saturday, and then they said, well, you know, you'll get the same money and so on and so forth, but we want to put you on Sunday afternoon. So it's been that way for the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. 32 years and counting, you know, and up until July will be 33 years.
In all those years, you have rarely missed a show. How many shows have you taken off in all those years?
Two. One, I attended a funeral, and the other one I had walking pneumonia or something, you know, that just caught up with me because I'm an energetic guy, and I'm still energetic, and every once in a while it catches up with me, and I remember I have to sleep, you know. So I've missed two shows.
So, you know, your show, The Art of Jazz, it's not just a show that you can just throw together. You know, it takes a lot of time and a lot of thought that goes into your show. How do you go about putting your show together?
I try to make the program not be a sales pitch. All I want to do is to present what I think human beings have done beautifully and leave it at that.
So, safe to assume that you don't do this show for the big bucks and the limousines and you know.
Oh, God.
So for the amount of time that you put into preparing for the show and the fact that, you know, you really haven't taken a weekend off.
Right.
What's your motivation to keep putting all of this hard work in week after week?
I'm old school that way. You give me a job to do, I do the job in the best possible way I can.
What is it that you personally enjoy about the music that you play on your show?
That's a good question, because I'm lucky. Even though I've heard these records a lot, it's new for me. And I'm always making new discoveries.
Is there a song that you've heard a million times that you could put it on today and still hear it and it still brings a real strong emotional feeling to you?
I think just a slow blues, piano, singer, whatever, gets to me. Because if the person who's performing it is an artist rather than someone that's trying to make it, quote unquote, mm-hmm. It's stunning. I mean, it really is. I sometimes laugh at the fact that Bessie Smith wouldn't have ever made it on American Idol. Well, I mean, think about it, because she's someone who wouldn't be able to be programmed into whatever it is that they do program into. And others, for sure.
What is the end reward for you for doing this show? What's the reward for you?
The satisfaction of sharing. I think that's the number one thing. Actually, I think, Kevin, it's another situation of teaching, although I don't want it to be teaching. I don't want to tell every chapter and verse of what this is. But the teaching is what I said earlier. I mean, this is a beautiful thing. We can read in the papers about all the bad stuff, but this is really incredible what human beings have created. But why? Because they're artists. And I also want people to know that the most important thing they can do for themselves is to find where that is for them. So if I touch somebody, you know, go out and get the music. I mean, have that be a part of you other than listening to it on the radio. Something for you, your art.
KPLU's Ken Wiley, host of The Art of Jazz every Sunday from 3 to 6. Ken, thanks so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, Kevin. Thank you.
Sound Effects senior producer is Arwin Nix, who manages to be one of maybe three people on the planet with the ability to share an office the size of a California king bed with me day in and day out without losing her mind. Thank you for your constant patience. We had stories this week from KPLU's Ashley Gross and from Sam Horn and Austin Hilliker. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We want to know what you think of the show. Send us your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org, or you can tweet us at KPLU. You can also leave us a review at iTunes and go there to sign up for our podcast. Our fearless host, Gabriel Spitzer, returns next week. I'm Kevin Kniestad, and this is 88.5 KPLU.